The E-Commerce Uncovered podcast is a behind-the-scenes look at what makes e-commerce a success in today's ever-growing and continually changing online world. The podcasts look to uncover the secrets of e-commerce success so you can learn and apply to your own online business. Brought to you by the co-founders of Core Fulfillment, one of the UK's leading e-commerce fulfillment providers, Paul Burns and Jeremy Vernon.
Hi, Jeremy Vernon here. Once again, thank you very much for subscribing to E-Commerce Uncovered. Today, I ventured down to Dorset to meet our next guest, who is a British artist, made his name as an artist, but also on another side, which is more relevant to the podcast that we do, has an e-commerce interest as well. That e-commerce business is selling paints, and those paints really have been innovated through his sort of art side of what he does, and he wanted to share these colours with other people, and really fell into this a little bit as a, not a mistake, but more of an accidental success. Really interesting story. Stuart's a lovely guy, really likes sharing with people, and that really comes through. His passion really comes through about letting other people have access to his paints and his colours that he's innovated for his own work. We also touch on a little bit of a feud that he's had with the artist Anish Kapoor, which drove another product that he innovated. And actually, this is sort of very timely in the sense that this is a year anniversary since the launch of one of those products. So keep listening. Coming up, Stuart Semple, the British artist. I do hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome, Stuart Semple. Thank you very much for coming to inviting me down to Pool, aren't we? In your, would you call this an art studio or a production studio?
I think
studio?
This is more like the office.
The office.
I don't know, but we do make stuff.
It's not a conventional office.
No, it doesn't look like a normal office.
Okay, well, thanks very much for having me down here today and doing this with us. It's an absolute privilege to be here. Just for anyone that doesn't know who Stuart Semple is, would you mind giving a quick introduction to who you are?
Yeah, so really I'm a contemporary artist, so I make art for big art projects all over the world, but I happen to have kind of become a bit of a sort of colour innovator. So I also come up with the world's artiest art materials, which we disseminate to people all over the world that use them and make cool things with them.
So what drove you to innovate with products, with colours, and let other people have access to those? What drove that innovation?
Okay. So there's a few pieces to that story. So the first thing is that in terms of inventing the colours, I've been making my own paint since I was a kid, really, trying to make things more powerful and more potent than what I could get in the shops.
In your own work?
Yeah, for my own paintings, just for my own use. And as I've done exhibitions and shows, I've developed new materials, really. And that got to a point where I decided it would be nice to share them with other people. And then parallel to that, there's been this engagement, if you like, with the internet since I was a teenager, really, and what an online community can be, or how you can communicate, I think, with a group of people. So those things kind of merged in the idea of how can we use the internet to really connect with real human beings, with real stuff that they can really use.
Okay. And why the colours? Why particularly that thing that you chose to...
Well, I've always been fascinated with colour. So okay. Since I was a kid, I went to see a Van Gogh exhibition when I was 8, and those colours just burnt into my mind. And I couldn't find colours that powerful on the high street in art shops because they didn't exist. Because in those days, artists made their own colours, and that kind of got forgotten in the 80s, maybe, when stuff started to become mass-produced. And I wanted to go back to a time where we had really awesome stuff. So I was always on this quest for, like, the ultimate colours.
How did you even begin the production of these colours? Because obviously you did it for yourself.
Yeah.
But obviously doing it for yourself and then putting it out as a product for people to buy online is a very, very different thing. How did you cope with the transition from making it for yourself through to making it for others?
Okay, so that's a big question. So some of the colours were more developed than others, and the pink was kind of ready and safe, and I knew its ingredients were good. So when I made the leap into sharing that wasn't because I wanted to sell loads of paint. So I think an important thing to understand is that the whole e-commerce thing that happened, and the success of these colours was a complete fluke. So it wasn't something that I intended to happen. So I put the pink paint on the internet as a joke because I thought my community and my followers would find it funny. I wasn't actually expecting anybody to kind of add it to cart, and I certainly wasn't expecting thousands and thousands and thousands of people to add it to the cart, which is where you guys kind of came in, because I remember, I think, ringing Paul and going, holy cow, I need your help. I don't know what to do. My mum's house is covered in pink powder.
I remember the conversation.
And we don't know what we're doing. And we,
So it's an accidental success in some ways.
Yeah, totally.
Why do you think that was?
I think if we'd have tried to do it, it wouldn't have worked, you know, because I think we'd have overcomplicated it. Looking at it now, I can see the ingredients that made it work. And I think it's not to kind of belittle anybody, but the things we've made are really good things. And I think because they're really good things, people want to talk about them and they want to use them. So I think at its core, the actual thing's good. And I think that's helped. I think the other thing is that the community we have of artists around the world that are connected on the internet and can communicate in a way they couldn't before are ready to support another artist making something for them. And I think for a very long time, they've kind of been underserved and they've been sold bad stuff. I think the other thing is that there's a story behind the materials. There's a reason why I released it. It makes a point. You know, it's almost a piece of art in its own right. And I think people kind of get that. And there's a community that have engaged with that.
Has this success through providing this, these materials and effect and the colours through for others affected your success as an artist? Has it helped? Have you seen any difference in your personal profile as a result?
Well, there's been a few things. So yes and no. So it's helped and it's hindered, because where it's hindered is I haven't had as much time with my own work as I used to. And a lot of people know me as the black paint guy.
We'll come on to that.
Which we'll come on to, or, you know, so they, rather than the artist, because, like, you know, I've been making my art for a long time and I've done okay in the art world as well. It's just the mainstream bloke on the street now knows about this. So it's a burden, but a burden that I'm happy with.
Okay, great. Yeah. We touched on black. We might as well go into that, because I think this is a fascinating story. And again, probably accidental success as a result, and driven by passion. It's obvious that, that's the case.
Yeah.
Obviously, Anish Kapoor and Vanta Black, would you like to just explain a little
about that? So I'll explain the scenario around that. So there was a lab, a science lab called Surrey Nanosystems, and they invented the world's blackest black material. This stuff absorbs 99.8% of light, so you can paint it on something. And for those listening, imagine you paint a sculpture in it. That thing now looks like a black hole. It absorbs light. It's like a cutout in the universe. And that's awesome. And everybody loves that. So the artist Anish Kapoor, for those that don't know, really big, really famous, really powerful artist, secured the exclusive rights to use it for art. So no other artist could use this stuff to make art. I thought that was really mean. Most of the art community thought that was really mean. I then decided I'd release the pink and ban him from using it. So at the checkout on the web store, you had to agree that you weren't Anish Kapoor, you weren't buying it for Anish Kapoor, and you weren't
in
the
show. Has he ever bought it, to your knowledge?
He bought it, yeah.
He did?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I never realised.
So, yeah, so his gallery bought it, and he acquired the pink, and then he put a post on his Instagram of him dipping his middle finger in it, and he said, up yours, pink. At that point, the art community went absolutely bananas about it, because they then really turned on him. They really hated it and they thought it was like the meanest, worst thing ever. And then they started lobbying me as to what I was going to do about the fact he'd got our pink, which we kind of distributed for what it cost us to make it in the first place. It was never like a money thing and everyone was really upset that he had it. And they started lobbying me to make a black as good as his black that they could use and he couldn't use. And I didn't really know how to do it. So I made a version of black the best I could with what we had. And I think we distributed it to about 1,000 artists as a sort of beta version. And we asked for their feedback and let us know how we can make it better and how we can change it and what you'd like it to do. And sure enough, they started writing suggestions in. And we put all that information together as a community, and we made Black 2, which is our super black that I think something like, I don't know the numbers, something getting on for at least tens and tens of thousands of artists are using now. And Anish Kapoor can't use it.
How did you even start that process to the Nanosystems company? What was that paint specifically designed for? It's quite
It's a very technical, high-level paint. It's mainly for engineering applications.
I thought it was really something quite high-level.
It's for, like, NASA to put into telescopes to stop stray light or whatever. But they've worked with, like, watch manufacturers, car manufacturers. It's very... They're not interested in the artist in their bedroom, if you like.
So how did you go and develop a black that was, if you consider, on a par with that from an artist's perspective? Where did you even start for that?
So what we started with was looking at paint. The difference between us and them is they're not paint makers. They're a chemical company that grow nanoparticles on stuff in vacuum chambers. We
very
don't
scientific.
Understand that stuff. We have no clue. But we have the whole history of art and paint making. We know what the blackest pigments are. They've been around for ages. We also know what acrylic binders there are for acrylic paints. And really, it's a case of finding an acrylic binder that's very open, so it can take more pigment than other binders. So we found that if you put 5 to 10 times more pigment in a binder, you get 5 to 10 times more colour depth. So what we did is we basically just didn't cheap out. We made a really great black paint, and we also added mattifiers in it. So we spoke to the cosmetics industry, who are using it in, like, to mattify skin for, like, selfies and stuff. We worked out how we could put that into the product without making it go white, and then we started to get a really good low reflectance black paint.
Did you ever think as an artist you would be innovating products to use it for other people in art and things like that?
No, not at all. I always thought I'd have to make my own stuff, but I never really thought that would happen. But I suppose I've been asked to do it. There's enough people that want it. It's sort of my job to keep going, I think.
You seem to be very much of the mindset of sharing things.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Because you obviously, sometimes I don't think people realise how much effort goes into things that you do, and obviously serving lots of people.
Yeah.
Where's that sharing mentality come from?
So I think that this is key to the whole thing, and this gets to the crux of where does the artist fit in tech? Because artists do something that other people don't. What we do is we understand there's a viewer on the other side of the things we make. So there's always an audience for what we make. If I make a painting, it's not really complete till someone stands in front of it. So artists make things to share and to communicate. The big thing that's happened to artists, at least in my time, is the birth of the internet. Our audience is now a global connected audience, where in the mid-90s it wasn't. So for me, when I was a teenager, I started sharing my work online, 1999, on eBay. It was the only place you could upload an image. We didn't have social media. We didn't have a Facebook, we didn't even have a MySpace, but I could upload an image on eBay and people could click to buy it. And I sold 3,000 works of art by the time I was 21 to people all over the world. And I used to run down the post office with 3 pictures a day.
So you actually started as e-com then, effectively?
E-com's been there since the start of e-com.
Okay,
like,
great.
There was nobody selling art on eBay when I was selling art on eBay, original art on eBay. And I sold 3,000 works of art to people all over the world who have kept it and have had it in their life. And what I realised is you build a connection and you build a community, and people have a real thing of mine in their house in Norway or whatever. I mean, there's something really beautiful about that. Yeah, of course it's sharing something, sharing an idea, but I think that's the beauty of the internet. It's that equal kind of playing field. So I don't think that what we've done with the paint necessarily is different than the rest of my work, which has always been about getting things to people and just kind of equalising the playing field. Like, every person's a person, and, you know, I just sort of didn't really like the elitism of having to go into a posh art gallery to kind of buy something all the time. I mean, there's a place for that.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed you say, certainly in your videos, when you're talking about your products, is that you sell them at the cost that it takes to make them.
Yeah.
So there's no profit motive for you in that.
No.
Why is that? When there's no harm in making money out of these things. You put a lot of effort into it. You innovate the products. Why do you then go and sell all of them at cost, in effect, with no profit?
Because I sell my paintings and I do my art projects, and I don't necessarily need to make money out of other artists because I see other artists as my friends. And I don't need to. Whereas somebody like Surrey Nanosystems, their job is to pay their shareholders from the products that they sell, and they need to sell them at the highest price, etc. What I want to do is I want to make my products or these products accessible to as many people as possible, because I think good art needs good materials. And I think that if I can make mine the same price as other brands and actually give artists the quality they deserve, then we all get better stuff to play with.
Okay, great. You've mentioned money.
Yeah.
Making money and art. Mm. Presumably there's quite a fine balance there as an artist.
Yeah.
That it's not necessarily all about the money.
No.
But you wouldn't be able to do what you do now.
Yes.
Without making money.
Yes.
How do you see that? Because I'm sure there's thousands of struggling artists out there that can't monetize what they do, haven't found the right audience.
Yeah.
You found an audience that appreciate what you do, and you've obviously monetized that and now giving back in a way that, you know, innovating art material so they can go and do their own thing.
Yeah.
Where's the balance there? And I'm sure for you, is it quite a hard one to try and justify in your own mind?
Not really. Like, okay, first of all, I think I'm very lucky that the sort of thing I make, people like and want to buy.
You know, is that through hard work or is that luck?
I don't know. A bit of both, maybe. But I know people who make great work that's really obscure, that perhaps nobody wants to buy, but the world's better for having it. So I admire that. I'm lucky that I do make things that people do kind of want to put on their wall, I suppose. So in that respect, I'm lucky. But I've come up with this idea that, and it's a sort of statement that I've come up with, that commerce follows culture, not the other way around. So you can't make something commercial and hope to tack culture on later. You make something culturally interesting and then the commerce will follow. So the Tate might not charge you to get in, but you'll buy a coffee and maybe get something at the gift shop afterwards. The gift shop's after the cultural experience. And I think really that's how you add real value. So you don't show up looking to make money, but if you show up and you do something well, somebody might give you some money for your troubles, a bit like a busker. Turn up on the street. If you're good, someone will put some money in the thing.
It's also like business. I think a lot of people, if they provide value up front, the money will follow, won't it?
If you're doing something good, people are going to queue up and want it. Yeah. Like, that's the law of the market.
I guess there's a point that you don't know whether that money will follow. Was there a point in time when, I mean, obviously you started selling eBay quite early, so I guess there was an early indication that there was an appetite for your work. Mm. Was there any point in your career that you were producing what you thought was your best work at that time and no one was paying any attention to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has happened loads of times. I mean, there's loads of things I've done that have been complete flops. I mean, more things haven't worked than have worked. And there's been times where I feel like I've done things because I needed money, and they were the ones that flopped the most. And
the intention was wrong.
The intention was wrong. And the things that I've done for the sake of doing them, art for the sake of art, or making stuff for the sake of making stuff, that's the stuff that's done really well. So I think, you're right. The intention in how you show up seems to have an impact on the result you get.
Going back to your products, do you want to just talk a little bit about, obviously Culture Hustle is the brand that you're using to sell the e-com side of your business, to sell these products. Just go through a little bit about the products that you that you developed, because I think there's lots of interesting things.
So first of all, like, obviously it started on my mum's kitchen table with the pink, and it grew quite quickly into being quite, I think we've got like 30 odd products now, and there's lots in development. And, you know, we're always in touch with our audience, so we know what they need and what they want and what they like. And the requests come in daily for can you make it do this and can you make it do that? But I'm really keen to do two things. One, make really amazing quality stuff that really shows in a lot of ways how, in fact, artists have been ripped off for a long time. So that's part of it. And the other thing is just to make materials that have potential where materials haven't before. So the recent sort of big release was a product called Lit, which is the world's most powerful glowing pigment. This stuff emits light for 12 hours off a small charge. It's so bright, you can see it in daylight. It's a light emitting pigment, it's amazing. And the success of that's been quite good. And not even just in artists, there's people wanting to use it in like road coverings, in like developing countries, so that speed humps and power cuts and, you know, it's things that we didn't even imagine that's coming out of the Lit product. But there's a whole range. I've got 9 different potion colours, which are the best quality acrylic paints you can buy. And they all have different smells. We have colour changing paints that turn from the pinkest pink to purple. We have living paints, so our rainbow liquid is a living microorganism, which is a liquid crystal, which is very rare. It's one of the most expensive art materials on the planet. People can buy 2 milliliters of it. They have to keep it in their refrigerator. They have to shake it to keep it alive. It morphs through the whole colour spectrum.
So where do these ideas come from for all of these different products? And I know, obviously, you've done it before, but glowing paint or using live organisms in paint, where does all this come from?
I don't know, just a desire to like push it in places it hasn't been and just ask really big questions like, is it possible to do this? What if it did that? Who's doing this?
And presumably not taking no for an answer when you're given that.
I mean, you wouldn't believe, like, it's always no. Like, it always starts with no. Like, not just like, and even in business, like some of the paint manufacturers you want to deal with or pigment companies, you know, initially it's no, you're not big enough, no, it won't do that, no, we don't do this. And after a few conversations, it's like, yeah, but you could, if you put that with that and put it here, it would do this. Can you try? Can you humor us? So it's like that approach.
We were just speaking earlier, you've now had to sort of outsource presumably quite a bit of the production side of things. Obviously, you've got some bottling going on here, as we can see. But you've obviously had to scale that up and outsource that. Tell us a little bit like how you did that.
Well, that was quite a big step for us because we looked at it in two ways. One, we could make a massive investment in equipment and bottling machines for very viscous paint. It was actually quite expensive. So we didn't have the facility to do that. And where the black got really big, really fast, we couldn't keep up. So we have a factory that does all the kind of bottling and stuff for the black now. And the black's made in Germany for us to our recipe. And it comes in and then it's bottled. And then obviously you guys get it to the artists that use it, which is brilliant. So that's been a big step. And then the powder colours are now being made in a monthly mega batch for us in a different factory. But there's still a lot of hand work done and it's still to like our recipe. And it certainly all very much originates here. And we make those batches here. And a lot of them are still done here. The potions are still done here. So where we can, we do. And then when it gets to a stage where we can't, then we kind of have to call in the big guns kind of thing.
We've just passed the year anniversary of Black 2.
Yeah.
And I've seen you've done an anniversary special of the paint. So you've tell us a little bit like what you did there. You went to 10 of your customers, is that right?
Yeah, so 10 artists that use black that we've seen their work and we really like what they're making. And we reached out to them and said, we'd love to put your work on the bottles for a special limited edition. So we made 100 bottles of each of the artists' designs and the next 1,000 bottles we send out will have their work on them.
And are they available now?
They're available now.
Yeah, so people can go and get those.
They've been going out, yeah. And they don't cost any more or anything. We just thought it was a really nice way of bringing it full circle, really, bringing the artist's work back into the product and sharing that. They've come out really nicely, actually.
You obviously like innovating with products, which is, I think, is fantastic because you never sit still. You're always trying to look for the next thing. You've mentioned Black 3. Do you want to mention a little bit about that?
There will be a Black 3. What am I willing to say? we're making our own pigment from scratch.
Top secret. All secret.
Yeah, there is a lab in Texas that is making a pigment that is a kind of pigment that nobody's ever seen that has all the properties you'd want in a black pigment. And we've got it and we've been playing with it and it's insane. And we're now working to put that into a couple of paint products that will mean that everything everybody dreamt of doing with Black 2, they'll be able to do.
To Vanta Blank, Black will be just...
It's gone.
There's no point.
It's gone.
When will you expect that to be available for your customers?
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's when it's ready. It's one of these, when it's ready, it's ready.
But it's just being worked on as we speak.
It's being worked on. We're quite far along.
Okay.
But I wish I knew the answer, but it's like, you know, that like labs and tests and results come and then you tweak and you don't know how much you need to do until you need to do it, kind of thing. Because it's all unmapped territory. So you hit something and it's like, oh, now we've got to deal with this. Now we've got to deal with that. So it will come.
Okay.
I mean, we've played with it.
You're happy with it?
It's going to do it, yeah.
Great, great. Just doing a bit of research for today, came across your hostile design. Thought was really
beautiful.
Intriguing. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I'd really love to talk about that.
Why you've done it for one as well?
Yeah, so a big part of my work is inclusion and the fact that everybody should be equal and have access to everything. And one of the things I've been doing, or I do in my work, is public art, so quite big public art projects. And I've been working with the City of Denver on a mega project called Happy City, which is basically a public art infrastructure design project, which is about train stations and public services and all this kind of stuff. And I've noticed this trend of hostile design creeping into the public realm. So, for instance, horrible bars being put on benches, spikes being put outside restaurants.
To stop homeless sleeping there and things like that.
Yeah, to stop the homeless from sleeping there or being there. Also, sound devices that emit frequencies to stop the youth congregating. Things to stop skateboarders. So really just kind of really mean-spirited kind of policing of public space to kind of drive out people that might not be desirable. And I think that's really mean. So we set up hostiledesign.org, a website, which you guys have been fulfilling the stickers from. And we're encouraging people to put these stickers on pieces of hostile design in their own towns and cities and then share those images on Instagram. And then the site pulls in these hostile designs and we start to have a database of them where we call out people who are doing it. And we've had some quite big successes already.
Yeah,
it's only a couple of months old. Already the hostile bars were taken down in Bournemouth in the town centre overnight by the council. They didn't like the negative press, which was brilliant. Mumbai in India have just removed their hostile spikes and replaced them with flowers.
Excellent.
And a particularly nasty example in Toronto has been taken down now. So this campaign proves that, yes, it might just be getting some stickers in the post that you can pay what you want for, but this awareness raising and this shaming and this idea that doing it is wrong is starting to change the attitude. And that's quite a powerful thing.
Do you think as an artist you've got sort of a gift in some ways to help with things like that? You've got an avenue to communicate to the wider audience about things like this, because I guess if we just walk past something like that in the street, we probably wouldn't even notice.
Most people don't even notice what that bar means. They think, is it to help an old person sit down? Is it useful in some way? And I don't see it like that. Maybe I've got a different perspective. So with that, I took a photo and I put it on my Facebook and it went viral. I went to sleep. I woke up the next day and it had a million shares
Gosh.
Overnight. And then I realised, actually, I do have an audience and people do see what I do. And do I therefore have a responsibility to use that, or can I contribute that to make things better? And something simple like hostile design seems to work. So I don't think every artist has to do it. I don't think, you have to make socially engaged work. You make art about whatever you want, paint your cat. But, you know, I kind of want to make things better with what I do.
Yeah. Just nice to see you. I feel from sort of our perspective, there's a balance between what you do, balance between the messages you want to send out, the help and the sharing that you want to, you know, with your products, for example. And obviously then keeping doing what you do as an artist in terms of, there's a much wider element to your business, isn't there?
Yeah.
I've seen some of the canvas, you do quite large format canvases, don't you? And things like that. I did notice the Smeg fridge doors that you do. What was that one? Because that looks amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so that was a series of works made for a shard in Hong Kong. They're just sculptures, but they're about poetry. So I put poetry on Smeg fridges, basically, that I fabricated, because I realised people had less and less time to communicate and people were leaving notes for one another on the fridge. And I was like, actually, how cinematic can I get in a few words? Can I actually give like a whole picture and a whole story in a few words on a fridge, which I made for an exhibition? But yeah, my own paintings are interesting because they deal with social issues and they kind of document it and they talk about what's happening. But I think some of this other stuff, like what I'm doing with Culture Hustle or the Hostile Design, is actually doing something physically about it. Because it's all very well to sit in your studio and whinge on about it in your paintings and put them up at a show. But actually, is there a point where you do something about it? And I see a lot of this other stuff, like the stuff we're doing, particularly online, is more of an activistic kind of thing.
Yeah. When did you realise that your messages were being listened to? Because obviously, as you say, your paintings have these messages in them and your art has these messages.
Yeah, I think it changed with the pink paint because I'd done a lot of art shows. The art world understood what I was making. People talked about my ideas, but that's a niche audience, you know. And then when we put the pink out and then the black, I mean, it went so big so quickly, you know, like GQ writing about it, Wired writing about it. It's on the new, you know, it went very mass, very quick. Literally, people I didn't know were stopping me and asking about paint in the street. I was like, actually, there's a reach here and I could do one of two things. I could run away from it or I could embrace it and try and do something with it. And that's what I tried to do.
Excellent. So what's next for Culture Hustle then?
More products, just more products. We're working on new stuff all the time and just really trying to give people what they need to make better art and better platforms and, you know, just keeping that connection as direct as we can to the audience and making things for other artists and just contributing.
You obviously interact with your customers quite a lot and your audience. And obviously we can see an example of that with the special edition blacks.
Yeah.
Does it motivate you to see the successes of some of your sort of followers, some of your customers?
Oh, I love it. There's nothing more exciting. Like every day I wake up and the first thing I do in the morning is I check the Instagram for the Share the Black hashtag and I look at what people have made while I was asleep. I'm like, oh, wow, this person's made this person's made that. And I normally comment and answer all my messages myself. And I know most of the people that use our stuff and like they're our friends, you know.
How do you think that's, you're obviously scaling as a business. There's obviously this momentum that you're building. Do you think that personal touch will be maintained as you scale further and further? Because obviously you're constantly innovating, you're selling more and more products, your reach is getting wider. How do you feel about the whole personal touch interaction you currently have with your audience? Is it going to stay as personal as it currently is?
Yeah, well, yeah, I hope so, or at least for as long as possible. And, you know, where I can find a way to do it, I will, because I think it's really important. And actually, there's been things that have popped up that could have made it go bigger, but I noticed that I'd lose contact with the audience. So, for example, physical retail is something I've said no to. Now, that's like, why on earth would you do that? We've got art stores throughout America. You could sell 10 million units. Why? Because I know artists are going to walk in. They're not going to understand the product. They're not going to get the connection. They're not going to get the customer support. They're not going to get that interaction with us. And with you guys, you know, with like what Carrie and everyone there is doing to help our customers is fantastic because we know we can support them. They can write to us and say, I'm trying to make it do this. I'm trying to make it do that. What do I do? And I want to be there for them. I can't do that in a store in Ohio.
No.
And that's why I said no.
And presumably as well, the profit motive that we spoke about earlier, yes, you could probably commercialise this and make more money at it if you chose to take that route, but that doesn't seem like the route that motivates you at all.
No, it doesn't have to be bigger to be good. Things can be small and great, and I don't know, it would take a lot to tempt me. It would need to be more than money, you know.
Yeah, okay. It's been a great chat. I really, really appreciate your honesty and taking the time out to do this today. So
it's been fun.
Thank you very much. It's been great. And we'll look forward to the Black 3 coming out.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.